This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There are many ways to think about history. We weave the narrative of our lives, our troubles, our joys, and conflicts into everything we do. And that includes what we eat. To commemorate Black History Month, we're going to take a look at the story of African Americans through the lens of Southern cooking. The very fact that certain foods are even on the menu in most American restaurants today tells a story of how Africans came to this country and what happened when they got here. We'll hear about that. We'll also talk about how Southern cooking has come to be known by many as soul food, what that means and what it doesn't, and how the term soul food has come to mean more than just food. And we want to hear from you. What are the stories that end up on your dinner table? Give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Yams, rice, greens, okra, cornbread, those are the things that NPR's Verda Mae Grosvenor studies. She's been doing culinary anthropology for more than three decades. She's the author of Vibration Cooking or The Travel Notes of a Geechee Girl. And Verda Mae cooks in the America's Family Kitchen. And she joins us now here in Studio 3A. Verda Mae, always good to have you on the show.
It's nice to be here.
Let's focus on one food that is full of history, rice.
Oh, yeah.
Where do we pick up this thread?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm from Carolina, and growing up there in the Low Country, we were known as rice eaters, and it was derogatory when we moved to the north. You know what I mean? We were those, and of course the Gullah with the Gullah language. We were those bad talking Geechee, rice eating Geechees from South Carolina. So, you know, I didn't even know. I saw no history in that. I just thought that was really something bad that, you know, you did. And other people had mashed potatoes. I'd lie at school and say, we had mashed potatoes last night. And, of course, we had rice. But even if you have mashed potatoes, you're going to have rice. If you have macaroni and cheese, you're going to have rice. But as I began my exploration into what I call the Afro-Atlantic foodways, I discovered a very important thing about Carolina. The reason that Carolina people, black, white, Gullah, otherwise, eat so much rice is, I mean, it grew there. It grew there. The planters, as a matter of fact, brought and bought those Africans from the parts of Africa where they had already been cultivating rice, because they were European. They didn't know anything about the cultivation of rice, and the climatic conditions were excellent, and they became actually some of the wealthiest men in the colonies. Those rice plantations made them lots of money. Mm-hmm. And so rice, as you know, I said, okay, it's all right to eat rice. And but of course, I thought as a kid, after we moved north, that I would never eat rice in public. I'd never eat rice in my own house. I'd never have rice on my shelf in my pantry, you know. And I didn't, of course, all that changed. I didn't know there were so many kinds of rice. And I didn't know that I had such a shared history with billions of people in the world eating rice. Mm-hmm. You know,
one of the my childhood memories, though, is that radio jingle of you know, I come from Carolina, so pardon my drawl, I'm here to sell Carolina rice to y'all. and please excuse the accent, but you know, that suggests, you know, that really this became a you know, it was not exclusively an African American thing, obviously. And what a lot of what you're talking about is what happens when you know, the foods of one culture, you know, impact with
that's
other
true.
Culture and
that's
mix
true.
And that's and mingle and share.
And that's true. I did a rice tasting with with Grace Young, who's written a book, a Chinese woman. And then there was a Japanese man from Northern California, and he grew rice. But we all talked about rice, and there were so many things that were the same. So, that's how you measure it too? Is that what you do? Oh, yes, we do that. And you say, you know, you're like, you belong to the world, but there's a way of using food to make people feel inferior.
Mm. Are there other foods that you know of that you think are really misunderstood?
Yeah. A lot of them. A lot of foods. I mean, for example, like I love collard greens.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually wonderful for you. And I had to travel to find out that, I mean, the Brazilians eat them. You know, they call them couve. And they fix them differently, but they're collard greens. And you're moving on up, you know, like when you're moving on up and you don't want to have your apartment in that, you know, that kind of fancy building, you know, smelling with the odor of collard greens. And I remember I was in Rome once, so going to visit a friend, and I was going to her apartment, I smell these collard greens. I know how collard greens smell. I mean, I knew that smell. But my friend didn't know those neighbors. Because I said, let's just, you know, just say hello. Maybe she'll give us some,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, but I didn't know what collard greens would be in Rome.
In some ways, does food represent a more honest history than some of the other ways we have of looking at the past? If you just look at the foods that people eat?
I think so. On the other hand, we have food historians who have really, like they've done a lot of the history. They've just changed it around. For example, one food historian said that sesame seeds, and we call them Benny seeds in Carolina, were brought to this country. You know, they're supposed to be good luck and all that.
Mm-hmm.
They were brought, that slaves brought them in their ears.
Really?
Well, now, yeah. She said, I think I'm just going to take me a few Benny seeds and put in my ears so when I get to the new world, I can, you know, have good luck or something.
As soon as we find bagels, we can put them on top.
Hey, there you go. There you go.
Joining us now is Norma Jean Darden, the co-author of Spoon Bread and Strawberry Wine, Recipes and Reminiscences from a Black Family. Also the owner of Spoon Bread 2, Miss Mamie and Miss Maud's 2 Harlem Eateries in New York City. And she joins us on the phone, joins us now from our New York Bureau. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon, both.
Hello.
Hi.
By the very title of your book, you suggest that you see recipes as a way of preserving family history.
Well, yes. It was just an adventure that happened to me, actually. I had no intentions of getting in the food business. I knew Verda. I had her book, and I was satisfied. But along came an editor from Vogue. At the time, I was a fashion model, and I remarked to her one day that my grandfather had been born a slave. And she thought that was rather amazing, since at the time I was in my late 20s. And very few people my age could make that assertion. So she suggested to me, you must have a lot of wonderful recipes going back in time. And I, of course, shared that with my sister, who was a social worker. We were opposites. I was a Scorpio. She was a Taurus. And indeed, we realized that we had treasured recipes in the family that we didn't know how to reproduce. So it started a 7-year journey back south to talk to relatives to collect their recipes. And in the process, they brought out their stories, their photographs, souvenirs. And that's what culminated in our book, Spoon Bread and Strawberry Wine. We sort of traced our family through food back to slavery.
Well, some of the recipes, by the way, that we're talking about, Verda Mays and also Norma Jean Darden's, can be seen on our website, which is www.npr.org. Our phone number, if you'd like to join our conversation, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@npr.org. And why don't we begin with Sam, who joins us on the line from Miami, Florida.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Thank you. Enjoying the show today and just wanted to share our delightful experience with you. My wife and I were in Rome, and we were on the way to a jazz festival known as the Umbria Jazz Festival in the Umbria section of Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And we rented a car and went along a road to the little city called Perugia, where the festival is held. In any event, we got hungry, and we stopped along the side of the road, and lo and behold, we were served a wonderful collard green sandwich.
What did they call it, Sam?
Well, it was, I forget the name, but you could just, when you opened it up, you saw that this was a wonderful collard green sandwich with a few other condiments. And I wish
were
I could
cooked?
Remember the name, but it's failing me. And
But
it was just a delightful sandwich, and we wrote to many of our friends about that in a family letter, and just as your speaker was talking about collard greens and the aromas and everything, I couldn't help but remember that sandwich, so I wanted to take a moment to share that with you.
Norma Jean was just asking, were they cooked?
Yes, they were.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
they have to cook them.
Yes, it'd be a little
but
tough.
You know what happened? I did a very bad thing once, but I was tired. I was on deadline. And the woman said if I brought the article there to her, she'd give me my check that day. So when I was shopping early in the morning, I had a bunch of collard greens in my hand. And the woman behind me, a white woman, said, how do you people make those? And I was just tired. And so I said something mean. I told her we made a salad. She said, what kind of dressing? I said, Italian.
Well, if you're ever in that area of the world, between Rome and Perugia on a little country road, you would find this little restaurant, a little rest stop where you would find these wonderful collard green sandwiches.
Wait, you can just make them.
Yep, you
at
can.
Home.
Well,
yeah.
The Italian bread, though, that's maybe the secret, Sam.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right, and the dressing as well. So. Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much for sharing that with us,
Have
Sam.
A great day. Bye-bye.
You too.
Norma Jean Darden, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about your families and how you see your family history through the perspective of food.
Well, I saw more than that. I got a view of black life at the turn of the century, before we had deodorants, before we had toothpaste, and I asked my relatives who were up in their 80s, what did you do? And they used salt as a gargle, and of course, medicine was rare, so the cough medicine was a little bit of turpentine and honey, and they used charcoal to whiten the teeth, and would chew tar. And they used like a little stick to, dental floss was non-existent. So they were using that to clean between the teeth. And they were using all kinds of inventive things. Lemon juice to whiten your nails. You know, the beauty secrets were there too, as well as the food, what people were eating, what made them healthy. There was a lot of sweet potato going on, a lot of collard greens, string beans, but then people had gardens. So the food was going from garden to table. So they were very strong people, lived long lives, and did hard work. As one of my relatives said, if hard work could kill you, we'd all be dead.
All of that sounds pretty intriguing, except, you know, turpentine?
Yeah. Yes, a drop of turpentine.
Yep.
And chewing tar.
Yes, that was the cure for whitening teeth, tar. You could chew it and kept your teeth clean. I don't know what it did for your breath, but...
it's one of those opposites. It seems counterintuitive that you would chew tar and make your teeth turn black, but, you know, hey, whatever works.
Well, it's sort of like pavement. I guess it just solidifies and gets all the gook out.
By the way, you can take when when you squeeze lemons, you know, and you've cut them in half, you know you can rub them on your elbow when they're finished.
Oh, yes,
yeah,
to get rid of the rust.
That's right.
Well, Vernon,
and your knees.
I think we're going to have to stop it right there. Verda Mae Grosvenor, thanks so much for coming
Thank
in today.
Thank you.
If you want to see some of Verda Mae's recipes from Verda Mae Cooks in the America's Family Kitchen, go to our website at www.npr.org. We're talking about a look at African-American history through food. What are your favorite recipes and what stories do they tell? Give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or send us email, TOTN@npr.org. We'll be back with more after a break. I'm Neil Cohn, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cownan in Washington. We're talking about the role of Southern cooking, or what some call soul food, in African-American culture. Our guest is Norma Jean Darden. She's the author, or co-author, of Spoon Bread and Strawberry Wine, Recipes and Reminiscences from a Black Family. She's also owner of Spoon Bread 2, Miss Mamie, and Miss Maud's, two Harlem eateries in New York City. What are the stories that your family recipes tell, and what does soul food mean to you? You're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And why don't we go right to the callers? Our next caller is Jeff, who's with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Hi. Your show made me think back to my first encounters with Southern cooking, or at least some aspects of it. Pralines, for example, than which there is nothing sweeter. And grits, of course, buttery and salty and peppery all at the same time, and black-eyed peas. Now, interestingly, I encountered all of these on railroad dining cars in the 50s and 60s. And it occurs to me that's probably how a lot of people discovered Southern cooking and other kinds of cooking, is through travel. I happened to do it at a time when you could do it on the train, and I remember when I ordered my black-eyed peas, the waiter went back into the galley, and I could hear him yell out, "Give me some buckshot, young man," which is a lot easier to say than black-eyed peas. So that's where I first began to discover Southern cooking, and it's gone on from there.
Well, Norma Jean Darden, of course, the railroads play also a huge part in African-American history.
Oh, absolutely. If it weren't for the railroads, my father and uncles never would have gotten through college and through medical school. That was the way young men supported themselves and got through college in those days. You had something to eat, and at the end of the summer, you had your tuition. And that was a honored and revered profession. And I remember as a child growing up in Newark, New Jersey, and going back to visit in Wilson, North Carolina, my mother and father would put me on the train at 4 years old with a little name tag and a safety pin with my name and destination, and put me in the care of the Pullman porters, whose job it was to see that all the summer children got delivered to their cities and towns and relatives.
Jeff, were you that young?
I wasn't that. Well, I was when I encountered the pralines. My grandparents used to take us to the South during the wintertime and on vacation, and we were in Alabama when we discovered pralines. Later on, in the late 60s and early 70s in college and just after, I had become a rail fan, and I was on a sort of quest to pursue the railroad experience while it was disappearing, and sought out things like the dining cars.
Well, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go now to Lonnie, who's with us from Hayward, California.
Hi. This
Hi.
Is Lonnie. What a wonderful show. I am black and Chinese and born and raised in Hawaii. And my father was born in 1908, and he met my mother during World War II while he was there. And she was pure Chinese from, she was born and raised in Hawaii, but her mother was from China. And my grandparents, whom I didn't know, they all died before I was born, spoke Chinese. So it was a stormy relationship for 30 years, to say the least. But they were both butchers before they finally ended up doing what they were doing. My dad was a kosher butcher because he was grew up in Georgia and then moved to New York. He became a kosher butcher, but couldn't go back into cold storage because he injured his back during the war. And my mother was the first woman butcher in Hawaii. So my mother made, and at that time it was in the 50s, and at that time everybody on the island knew everybody who was black, and of course a lot of people were in the service, but there were a great number of black men, and I have to write this book one day, who stayed. And so every time someone new came from the mainland, the entire black community at that time was a territory knew, and once a month we had a huge thing at our house where about everybody on the island who was black, Oahu, showed up at our house, and my parents would cook themselves crazy. And both of them knew meat pieces. I mean, they knew slices of meat. They could look at a piece of meat and tell you the history of it, and it was just, it's disgusting. I didn't pick up on it. I was the only girl of five children. But I'm finding now, I'm in my 50s, that I'm cooking more and more, and I don't use recipes, more and more like my mother and father. My mother made sweet and sour chitlins, and people would come from all over the island asking, is Rose going to make her chitlins? My father would cook, you know, for a couple of days before. And all the things you had mentioned before with the lady who was there before, the lemon juice on the elbows and the knees, the stick for your teeth, gargling with salt, I learned that from my father.
Yes, those
he was born in the Deep South.
Those were the tricks.
Your thing made me real hungry. I've come to appreciate the diverse, just the richness. Plus, I was born and raised in Hawaii, and my mother, although she was poor Chinese, everything in Hawaii is flavored with Hawaiian of some kind. So I have this mixture of all kind of food. I mean, you never went to a business meeting. And with this emphasis now on weight and obesity, I support that. But you never went to a meeting, and still to this day in Hawaii, without someone bringing fruit from home or a cake they made, you never, ever get together in Hawaii. Same thing with black folks usually and with Chinese folks. But mostly the Hawaiian thing I remember, you never show up without some food, never. There's never a meeting in Hawaii without somebody's food. Somebody brings something. So it's a really rich, rich, rich heritage, and if nothing else, my parents could get together about cooking. They knew how to get together about cooking. And my mother made spaghetti. I always told people my mother makes the only Chinese spaghetti I know, because she would throw in vegetables that no one else who ate spaghetti ever heard of. And we called green onions Chinese parsley. No, cilantro.
Cilantro.
Yeah, cilantro.
Right. Yeah, it's Chinese parsley. I didn't know it was Chinese parsley until I came to the mainland. I mean, I didn't know they called it cilantro. I didn't know what they were talking about until I came to California. And I came in 68 for college. And the other black students had started calling this, we're going out for some soul food. I said, y'all call it soul food too? I thought my father named it that specially for me. Mm-hmm. I did not know, because there's a very small black community in Hawaii in the 50s and 60s. Sure. I said, y'all call it soul food too? And they looked at me like I was crazy. So those traditions and that history, so much of it for us revolve around food.
Well, it's so true, and particularly in funerals we found
that
there was a funeral in the black community, to offset the loss, people would bring together food
and
gather. Yes.
I was supposed to bring some food last night, and I didn't make it. They always, in the choirs, I sing in a big church, and they'll always, you know that they're going to say, bring the food over to our house the night before, because they got people coming in from out of town. And usually there's so much food that there's not enough people to eat all of it. They're just swamped with food. So it's a very rich cultural tradition, and there's so much heritage behind it. One last thing is, I was at Francis Coppola's place in Napa, and there was a woman there coming from Brooklyn College in New York who gave a discussion about the Afro-Caribbean origins of food and history around it, and she did a 2 or 3 day seminar up there. So it was wonderful to see that. It was last February. Coppola's place, I think it's called Copa.
Mm-hmm.
In Napa. So there are things that happen locally. People just have to look for them. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Well, thanks very much
for
the call.
Thanks for sharing.
Let's go now with Joe. And Joe's with us from Oxford, Mississippi.
Hey, guys.
How you doing?
Hi.
Doing pretty good today. Enjoying the show, as usual. I just wanted to talk a second about the cultural heritage that we all share with our food and with the history that we have personally. I'm from East Texas. And where I'm from is one of the most culturally diverse areas of the state. We have Hispanic culture, we have African-American culture, Native American, and the European-American culture that came in around 1825, 1835. The way I cook at the house reflects this. Black-eyed peas, collard greens, enchiladas, do pretty good getting the kids to eat. Doing pretty good getting the kids eating cornbreads, collard greens, and black-eyed peas, but when I start with the chili birdie and enchiladas, they kind of bail out and say, we're going to McDonald's.
Oh, dear. That's
my concern is, how do you keep the younger ones, how do you pass this on to them? Well, from where I'm sitting right now, I see a McAllister's, a Sonic, a pizza place, and a local chicken tender place. And, you know, you make the food that reflects who you are and where you've come from. And it's so hard to get the children, the adolescents today, to prevent them from becoming homogenized by this culture that's spreading over the whole country.
That is such a problem for me, because I remember as a child, as I told you, I would go south on the train. When we got to Wilson, there was Old Man Shades, and he made his own pineapple ice. And that was just such a treat. And then when I went to Opelika, Alabama, to visit my Aunt Maud, they had their own little drugstore, and they had Tutti Frutti ice cream. And, you know, you just, where you went was colored by what was there. But right now, when you wake up, you don't know where you are. You could be any place at any time. There's always a McDonald's, always a Burger King, a Wendy's. and Pizza Hut and a Holiday Inn. You wake up in a hotel. You could be anywhere from Texas to Utah, and you know, you wouldn't know unless you knew.
Exactly. Twice during the Christmas holidays, I sat down and made, I rolled and cooked enchiladas for people who came over. And my adolescents, 15-year-old and 17-year-old, basically were going, we're going to go get something real to eat.
Okay.
Oh, that's terrible.
But, you know, I guess everybody has these kinds of problems with their kids.
Yes, it's just, very real.
I just wanted to call and tell you I'm enjoying it. We all share a cultural heritage, and this enchiladas at Christmas is a tradition in my family. We're all my parents and my brother and I are all displaced Texans. We're in the South, but not in Texas, and so we celebrate our heritage by having enchiladas instead of turkey on Christmas Day.
Oh, I think that's just so special.
Thank you for letting me talk. I appreciate it.
Thanks
y'all
for the call,
Joe. Have a great day, and I'll keep listening.
Okay. We got an email from... Tahida, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, from Mesa, Arizona, who writes, my family's from Mississippi, and the one thing I remember hearing the most around the dinner table was the scandal of dirty greens. Basically, they're collard, mustard, or turnip greens that are gritty when eaten, at least in my community, Southside Chicago. This was the worst culinary faux pas one could commit. I even recall putting off serving greens to anyone but the closest of family members for fear of having my cooking abilities ridiculed based on this one food. I was wondering if your guest had ever heard of such behavior.
Oh, yes. We had a new person in the restaurant, and he almost ruined me one Mother's Day because he didn't. You have to wash. You really have to be so careful, especially if you have fresh greens. You have to wash them twice, and you have to let the dirt sink to the bottom of the tub. Then you have to take them out, and we kind of spend them, and then you wash them a second time. And if without that second washing, your whole reputation can go down the drain. I'm sure that first group that came out of the first pot on Mother's Day 2 years ago are just still having a terrible time with me, and I'm having a terrible time with them. So it's a very important thing to wash your greens until you can see them. You have to wash them just like clothes, and you know when your clothes are clean. So it's the same thing with greens. They need that meticulous wash, because stones and rocks and dirt and the greens just won't do.
We have an email, this one from Gabrielle in New York City. I remember when I arrived at college, the University of South Carolina in Columbia, South Carolina, and being shocked to see that everyone, both black and white, ate grits. I was so happy to this grits with fish, grits with cheese and bacon, and writes, I must have gained 15 pounds in my first year there. Which does raise the question. I mean, you know, if you are interested in that, in a little girth control, all these recipes seem to call for, you know, bacon or lard or you know, a lot of it can be very fattening.
Well, yes, but anything can be. And, of course, you exercise. And grits are a potato substitute, but actually they give you a little more fiber. So, actually, grits are very good for you if you don't drown them in butter. It's like eating any other cereal.
Well, I suppose escargot are good for you if you don't drown them in butter. But otherwise, what's the point?
Well, the point is to be healthy and to enjoy your food.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go get another caller, and this is Bill, who's with us from Albemarle, North Carolina.
Hello, how y'all doing tonight?
Very well, thanks.
They brought back many, many memories of wonderful, wonderful spoon bread I haven't had in probably 30 years or so.
And it's so easy to fix.
I know, and can't find Grandma's recipe.
Oh, and
well, you can have mine. It's in my cookbook, Spoon Bread and Strawberry Wine, and we also have it on the Internet.
On the website at npr.org, where there's also recipes for Southern Fried Chicken and South Carolina Shrimp Purlieu. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, Southern Fried Chicken, I know well. Mom taught me how to fry that real good, so we do the Southern Fried Chicken really well. And but spoon bread and crackling spoon bread I haven't had in over 30 years, so just really great to hear that title, and I sure be looking for it.
Well, thanks very much for the call.
Y'all have a good evening.
You too. Here's a email from May. What great memories you brought back regarding turpentine. My father used it for all cuts, infections, and gum disease. It did not sting on a fresh cut. Also used salt and baking soda for cleaning teeth. He had all his teeth when he died at the age of 86, and we have no scars because of turpentine. All right?
Oh.
You're making me a believer now. And another question, this one from Gress LeMaist in Jacksonville, Florida. I grew up in northern Florida over 60 years ago in a very southern family. I was appalled some years later when soul food was touted as black food because it was the food we all ate, black and white, gizzard, spoon bread, okra, rice with gravy. I preferred butter and was considered to have Yankee blood because of it. Fried chicken, liver and bacon, Hoppin' John, and of course, hog jowls and Hoppin' John for New Year. Flavoring was usually from fat back and sugar. One thing about southern cooking, it's stick to your ribs cooking.
Well, she's right about that. Now, soul food cooking kind of comes because the slaves ate the leftover meats. They didn't have the top cuts, the butcher daughter was talking about. They had the innards of the pigs, and they had the leftover things, and they had to cook those well and flavor them well. And I think that probably is what distinguishes the black cooking from some of the white. And also, there were so many black cooks. That was cooking was relegated to a lot of the slaves. So that's why you found so many talented people working in food.
Well, Norma Jean Darden, it's been great fun. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I thank you so much. And when you come to New York, come to see me at Miss Mamie's on 110th or Miss Maud on 137th Street right here in the town of Harlem.
You can bet I will. Norma Jean Darden is co-author of Spoon Bread and Strawberry Wine, Recipes and Reminiscences from a Black Family. As she mentioned, she's the owner of some restaurants up in Harlem in New York City. And one final comment on soul food from Sugarcane Harris. The soul.